From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today, with so many new streaming services, will 2019 be the time we all cut the cord or go crazy trying? Then my conversation with the R&B musician who goes by the name Her. She has 5 Grammy nominations this year and says she has a good reason to keep her real identity secret.
A lot of people say, like, oh, we really don't know her, she's hiding. But I always say I'm not hiding. If anything, you know more about me than you ever would within my music.
And the Spanish singer Rosalia gives flamenco a modern twist. All that coming up after this short break. 2019 may very well be the year where we all go a little streaming crazy. Now, I know what you're thinking. Is this another story about traditional TV being upended by Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu? Well, sort of, and yet there's more. Traditional media companies are now getting a lot deeper into the streaming fight. CBS, Disney, Time Warner, and as of yesterday, NBC Universal now have either launched or will soon launch new streaming platforms. And the category killer, Netflix, just got pricier and raised its monthly subscription fees. To discuss all of the above, I called up Natalie Jarvie. She's a digital editor for The Hollywood Reporter, and she started with why Netflix raised its prices today.
Yeah, you know, Netflix has had increasing content spend for the last several years. And, you know, it takes a lot of money to make all these shows that they're releasing, you know, practically every week and to market them. So it's been expected that they would steadily increase prices for a while. And, you know, this time their most popular plan is going to cost about $2 more in the U.S. So, you know, it doesn't seem like a lot, but it is actually their largest price hike to date.
I want to step back and talk about what's really going on throughout Hollywood, and that is, for a long time, the people who are creating content, like Disney, NBC Universal, among many others, sold their content to Netflix just as they might sell it to a video store as kind of an ancillary revenue. But as Netflix became its own network, started producing its own movies and TV series, these content companies realized that they were essentially creating their own worst enemy. So now they're all either pulling that content back and or starting their own streaming service. Is that basically the revolution that's going on right now?
Absolutely. So last year we saw Disney and Warner Media both announce streaming services. Yesterday, NBC Universal is following suit and announced their service. Only Disney has said that they're going to pull their library from Netflix. But it's safe to assume that over the next few years, a lot of the programming that people have come to enjoy on Netflix will start to go away and become siloed in these different streaming services.
Before I ask you about some of the specific new streaming services, I want to ask a more broad question, and that is about what Netflix does well that these companies will have to emulate. Netflix spends a tremendous amount of money on technology, and it has a really good interface, and it's easy to use, and it streams pretty smoothly. How much of the digital experience is tied to that?
It's so important. I mean, you have to remember that Netflix basically invented the whole idea of binging television. And each of these companies is going to have to, you know, really beef up their technology abilities in order to be able to compete. So, you know, Disney went and bought BAMTech, and they're using BAMTech to kind of power their streaming services. NBC Universal is saying that they will bring over some folks from Sky who were involved in the launch of Sky Now, the streaming service that's available in Europe, to help them launch their service. But they're going to all be at a disadvantage because, you know, these companies, first and foremost, are entertainment companies. Netflix, first and foremost, is a technology company.
I think it's also important to note that one of the key drivers of Disney's $71 billion deal for most of Fox was that it wanted its share of Hulu. So now the new Disney-Fox entity will have about 60% of the company. So how is Hulu positioned to compete with Netflix, and what kind of threat does it present?
Hulu's at a really interesting spot. They've seen some really impressive growth over the last few years. They just announced that they've passed 25 million subscribers. The challenge for them now is that as they become, you know, majority owned by Disney, there's a good chance that the other partners in the service will start to pull back. So WarnerMedia has a share in Hulu and has suggested that they will sell that stake eventually. The big question is going to be what happens with NBC as they launch their streaming service. They seem to be implying that they can both remain a big shareholder in Hulu and also launch this own streaming service of theirs. But exactly how they'll split their content between those services will be really interesting to watch. And the Hulu proposition has always been about that, being able to watch shows from all these different broadcasters. If that starts to change, that proposition could change. But then they will also have the might of Disney behind them. And as Disney starts to roll out its streaming service and it has ESPN Plus, they can kind of bundle Hulu alongside those offerings. And that could be compelling to consumers still.
CBS was the first broadcast network to launch a streaming service. And something that CBS did that was notable is it created original content, original series, Star Trek Discovery, The Good Fight, which is a spinoff from The Good Wife. And then later this year, it will have Jordan Peele's remake of The Twilight Zone. So how is CBS All Access done, and what kind of model does it seem to be interested in following?
They don't have the same cable portfolio that NBC Universal and others do. So their service is largely a kind of additive for the broadcast channel. That means that they're goal is going to be a lot smaller than some of these other services. They've said that they wanted to reach 8 million subscribers between CBS All Access and sister service Showtime by 2020, and they're actually going to reach that goal ahead of schedule. So a big reason that they've been able to drive those subscribers is because of the original programming you mentioned.
So I'm going to ask you about the average consumer. If you're thinking about NBC's platform, CBS, Disney's new streaming service, Warner's streaming service, Hulu, does this actually fit into the whole idea of cord cutting and simplifying your life, or is it going to become too many options?
It's a double-edged sword. You know, people became frustrated with the cable bundle because it was expensive and hard to cancel, but it also made life really easy. Now, people are going to have to really start to manage how they're getting their shows. I mean, I don't know that the general consumer knows that Friends is a Warner Television show and that in order to get it, once it goes off of Netflix, they'll need to subscribe to Warner Brothers or the Warner Media Service. You know, that gets complicated. And I think that consumers will get frustrated by having to kind of manage all of these different services, not to mention the fact that you start to add them all up and it's not going to cost that much cheaper than just subscribing to cable.
Natalie Jarvie is the digital media editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Natalie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the R&B singer who goes by the name Her. Back in 2016, RCA Records released an EP by an anonymous musician with a brief statement that basically said, "We can't tell you much about her, but just give it a listen."
Baby, the sound of you.
Since then, the R&B artist who calls herself Her has released three additional EPs, attracted legions of fans, including Rihanna, Janet Jackson, and former President Barack Obama, and is nominated this year for 5 Grammy Awards, including Best New Artist and Album of the Year. Some music fans know Her's real name, but she asked us to identify her by her adopted acronym, which ironically stands for Having Everything Revealed. I spoke with Her when she was in town last week. She performed for the Grammys tribute to Aretha Franklin last weekend at the Shrine Auditorium. And we started with how her anonymous persona provides empowerment when it comes to her public image.
With social media, I think that's one of the main things people focus on is looks and who you're associated with and all the stuff that is superficial to me, you know. So I really wanted people to just listen to the music. I wanted the music to be the forefront. So I think it would have been a little bit different knowing, you know, my age and my name, seeing my face, all those things I think would have played a role in how they receive my music. And I didn't want that to happen.
And for people who don't know, HER is an acronym for Having Everything Revealed. What do those words mean to you about what you reveal and what you and how you see your own life revealed in music?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people say, like, oh, we really don't know her, she's hiding. But I always say I'm not hiding. If anything, you know more about me than you ever would within my music. You know, not knowing what I look like. It's all in the music and I'm having everything revealed in the music. That is the most honest version of me.
So you are in L.A. working on a Grammys tribute to Aretha Franklin. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about Aretha and what she meant to you and your growth as a musician. And what does it mean to be one of the musicians paying homage to her on the Grammy show?
Oh, my gosh. It's honestly such an honor because I grew up singing Aretha Franklin songs. Like, Freeway of Love was, like, one of the songs that I would perform all the time, like, at talent shows and things like that. So when I was a kid, I really, really looked up to Aretha. The soulfulness in her voice is probably, it's one of my biggest inspirations.
So when you were a kid belting out Aretha, were your parents saying louder or did they say cut that out?
They were definitely saying louder.
That's
right. Yeah, no, my parents have been a huge support system in my life, period. I mean, my dad's a musician, and he's the reason why I play music. I mean, it was because he had a cover band, and I had everything in my living room, you know, the bass, the guitar, the drums, and the keys, and I wanted to play them all.
I'm going to listen to a bit of your song. It's called Focus, and it's up for the best R&B song.
Can you focus on me?
How do you write? Do you picture a lyric? Do you picture a melody? Where does it start for you, even if it changes from song to song? How did it start on this one?
Yeah, it really depends. But I mean, this song, I heard the track, DJ Kemper. He's a really talented producer. He played me the track and I got really excited.
Stuck on your phone, are you stuck in your zone? And you don't ever clue, but I don't wanna give up.
It was actually sitting in my phone for a really long time and I pulled it out randomly and started singing the melodies first. And the melodies kind of sparked this mood of being very like vulnerable and needy and emotional.
Just focus on.
It's all real life. It's all my life. And it wasn't really a story until I made all of these songs. It wasn't like I put thought into a story because it was all happening. I didn't have to think about it because I was just expressing myself. I was just creating this music that was honest. And I knew I had to be honest because those are the best songs. But I didn't really look at the bigger picture until I realized, like, all of these songs that I'm writing are specific to this time period. You know, when I first released Volume 1, it was like I started to realize all these songs represent this time period of me being that girl, you know, in high school, going through all these changes and dealing with these new emotions and heartbreak and all the stuff that comes with that.
One of the things that I think is true about certain songs, and it's certainly true about your music, is that the more personal and specific it is, the more universal it can become.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that idea is amplified by the fact that since people don't really know you, they can project much more of themselves into the stories they're hearing lyrically.
Absolutely. I think her is like everybody. It's because, like you said, it's specific to me and specific to my life. The way that I've presented it and the way that people have taken it is just, it can be so many situations and different scales, you know, different levels.
We're talking with the singer and songwriter, her. She's nominated for 5 Grammys, including Best New Artist and Album of the Year. I got to ask you, when you were singing Aretha as a kid, did you also practice your Grammy speech way back then?
Absolutely. In my head, though. I was definitely, you know, having those nights where I couldn't sleep and thinking about that completely.
I want to play part of another song. This one is called Lost Souls. It's from your 2018 EP called I Used to Know Her, The Prelude.
Say you empower women, but don't acknowledge them. Feminism, not what you embody in. You false hope, you false positive. But eat your fruit and drink your water then. I don't click up.
So there's a reference to the 1998 song by Miss Lauryn Hill called Lost Ones.
Hypocrites always want to play in the sand. Always want to take it to the full out extent.
And I would say, compared to the subject matter of some of your other music, this song feels bigger. It's less personal, more about bigger issues. But I want to talk about Lauryn Hill a bit and how you see her music influencing what you do.
I love Lauren. She's very honest in her music. And I've been inspired by Miss Education for years. You know, it's like one of those albums like everybody needs to have heard the entire album. you know, especially as a woman, like it's just, it's necessary to life.
When you were growing up outside of Aretha and Lauryn Hill, were there other artists whose lives, the way they behaved, not so much their music, that you wanted to emulate, people that you thought were doing the right thing, even when they weren't in front of a microphone singing?
I mean, Prince. You know, Prince is definitely one of my biggest influences, even outside of music, which is crazy. He's actually, when he passed away, he was a Jehovah's Witness. And like, I grew up in Jehovah's Witness family. Like, it's kind of interesting having that relation. But he had this mystique about him. You know, he was very low key and just about his music. And I relate to that in so many ways. I don't even think it's something I emulate, but it's just something I naturally do. I've always been very private about my life and just about the music. And I'm a loner, you know, most of the time. And I think Prince was as well. So yeah, he's definitely a huge inspiration.
Prince was really good about including women in his collaborative process. And we cover Absolutely. The film industry a lot on our show. And something that stands out when we talk to female actors is how infrequently they get to work with other women. And I'm wondering if it's the same in music. And do you feel like women can support each other more in the industry, especially when it comes to how few women are producing music right now?
Yeah, no. I think more women need to acknowledge women. You know, I talk about it in Lost Souls. A lot of women, sometimes the industry, I think in any industry, it can be very high school, like very clique-ish, you know, very clout-driven and very popularity-driven. And I'm seeing a lot more women artists who are acknowledging other artists, because in order for us to receive the recognition we deserve, we have to acknowledge each other. That's something I feel really strongly about. And I'm seeing it more. There's a lot more camaraderie. I don't like to see other people belittle each other or think that they need to tear down somebody else to make themselves feel better about themselves. And that happens.
There's a lot of ways that an artist can measure his or her success. It could be albums sold. It could be what kind of playlist you end up, who's showing up at your concert. I want to ask you about somebody who put you on his playlist for best songs of 2018.
Yes.
That is Barack Obama.
Yes.
And your song could have been, what was it like to hear that news that you were the president's, one of the president's favorite songs? Because he's got really good taste.
Man, amazing taste. Like, I feel like, man, I can quit music. I'm good. I made it. You know, I think, no, that was just, that definitely made my entire year. Like, just to know that. It's incredible. It really is.
As we go out, I want to listen to a part of your song, Best Part, with Daniel Caesar. It's nominated for Best R&B Performance, and you performed it over the summer at the 2018 BET Awards.
Yes.
Can you tell us something about this song, what it means to you, before we start to hear it?
Yeah, I mean, the song means so much to me. I mean, the emotion itself, the nostalgia that it has, but how it came together so organically and so purely. We both love Lauryn Hill, we love D'Angelo, you know, and that was kind of the moment we were trying to create, and it happened so organically. So yeah, you know, for the lovers, Best Part.
You don't know, babe, when you hold me.
Her, thanks so much for coming on the show. Good luck at the Grammys.
Thank you so much.
You're the coffee that I need in the morning.
Coming up, flamenco music gets a 21st century update from the singer Rosalia.
Give it all, I just want to see, I just want to see.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. A rainy day like this is a perfect time to catch up on any episodes of The Frame that you might have missed. And the best way to do that is to subscribe to our daily podcast. And be sure to check out our recent interviews with Spike Lee and David Byrne and Samantha Bee. And by subscribing to our podcast, you'll be sure to follow our coverage of the upcoming Sundance Film Festival. It kicks off in a little more than a week. You can get The Frame podcast through Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or your favorite podcast provider. And now it's Spanish singer Rosalía. She's an artist you'll be hearing a lot about. In the past year, her career has skyrocketed. She's recorded with Pharrell Williams and shot a part for Spanish director Pedro Almodóvar's next film. And Rosalía's modern update of traditional flamenco music brought her 5 nominations and 2 wins at the recent Latin Grammy Awards. Frame contributor Beto Arcos recently caught up with her in Madrid.
Perhaps it's fitting that I meet Rosalía in a 16th century palace. These days, Rosalía is the equivalent of Spanish royalty. It's mid-afternoon in Madrid. Rosalía has been doing press interviews all day in a lavish salon and appears a bit frazzled. But she perks up when I tell her I just returned from walking 100 miles on the Camino de Santiago, a sacred pilgrimage in northern Spain. She says she walked the Camino 5 years ago and would like to repeat the experience if she ever has free time again. Rosalía is from a small town in Catalonia. She's 25 years old and grew up listening to the music her parents played at home, the Beatles, Queen, Supertramp. Then, when she was 13, flamenco entered her consciousness.
I heard it in the street with my friends. They were like older than me. They had the cars with the doors open, hearing the music super loud in the street. They used to hear flamenco, they used to hear Camarón.
Camarón de la Isla is considered the top flamenco figure of the 20th century.
In Camarón, it was like something that changed my life completely. It was like before and after Camarón, you know? I fall in love with this music and the way he used his voice.
Rosalía doesn't come from a musical family. She didn't know anything about flamenco when she began studying it.
And this music is so difficult, it's so difficult. I'm telling you, like, the rhythms, it's so difficult to understand at the beginning. You have to get very focused and study a lot to understand this type of music.
Rosalía says Camarón has been a major influence in her career.
He was so inspiring for my generation, and he was very open-minded. He always took risks doing his records.
Rosalía is also taking risks on her own records. Many in the traditional flamenco community criticized her first album called Los Ángeles. Among other things, she was accused by a Roma activist of cultural appropriation.
I guess that when you do something with risk, that risk makes you connect with a lot of people and not connect with a lot of people too.
José Manuel Gómez is a music critic based in Madrid. Gómez says Rosalía has engaged a new generation that has never heard flamenco before with an essential element every artist should have.
Los flamencos buenos.
The good flamenco artists will tell you the important thing is to communicate, to transmit. And Rosalía communicates. It's true, there are songs that communicate and others simply don't. But that happens with every other artist I listen to.
Rosalía's new album is a departure from the previous one. If the first album was minimalist, guitar and voice, this one has many layers of production and influences, from electronic music to R&B. It's flamenco for the 21st century, inspired by an anonymous novel from the Middle Ages called Flamenca. Rosalía says there are some traditional flamenco melodies, but there are many pieces she composed specifically for it. It's also a concept album.
And every song is a chapter. There's a whole story in the record, which is El Mal Querer, this bad loving, this story about a dark love.
Rosalía recently recorded 2 songs with singer and producer Pharrell Williams. She says it was a privilege to work with him in the studio, where she came to appreciate something special about him.
Wow, he loves flamenco too. He likes that. He was interested in that. He was like telling me that he believed in me and that he loved this culture, these flamenco melodies, that he was excited about that. And that was a surprise for me. That made me feel very happy and comfortable to make music with him.
Spanish director Pedro Almodóvar invited Rosalía to do a scene in Dolor y Gloria, his next film to be released next year.
Yeah, it was like a beautiful experience. It was my first scene in a movie. And the first scene with Almodóvar, it's kind of mind-blowing because he's my favorite artist in the world, probably.
Rosalía can only guess what the late legend Camarón de la Isla would say if he heard her music today. She certainly knows what she would say to him if she had the chance.
Because of him, I'm here. He changed my life when I was 13, and he's been like the most inspiring icon and musician from my country for me. And he's been so important. He was the door that I opened to discover all this music, and I love him.
For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos, in Madrid, Spain.
And that's our show for today. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here tomorrow.